This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get the reaction of a transgender Army reservist from Bloomington to President Trump's effort to rid the military of transgender people.
I would personally love for him to come stand right in front of me and tell me that I'm physically and emotionally unfit.
Charlie Schlinker talks with retired ISU provost and former Western Illinois University President Al Goldfarb, who is still writing. His new book is about theater throughout civilization. And we remember GLT corporate support manager and friend Liz Larson, who died after a boating mishap on Sunday. We'll also hear from GLT's Ryan Denham about a lawsuit associated with the Wilmington Dam where Larson died. It's the site of several drownings. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's July 31st, 2017.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We first brought you the story of 26-year-old Jordan Becker of Bloomington in 2015 as part of a series on transgender individuals living in the Twin Cities. Becker says he always wanted to be a soldier and is currently a decorated military policeman in the Army Reserves. Now, Donald Trump says he wants to rid the military of thousands of transgender soldiers like Becker. GLT's Judy Valente has more.
Bloomington resident Jordan Becker joined the Army National Guard in 2008 as Jordan Elizabeth Becker, a woman. In 2014, he dropped Elizabeth from his name, began hormone therapy, and had surgery to become a man. At the time, transgender individuals were not allowed to serve in the military, and he left the service. When the Obama administration changed that rule, Becker says he was ecstatic. He promptly reenlisted, this time in the Army Reserves. President Trump announced on Twitter last week that he wants transgender men and women out of the military. Becker says he is determined to stay.
I'm overwhelmed by the support that I've received after Trump tweeting that, but also it's extremely disheartening because I know for myself I've worked so hard to get my gender changed so I can conform to the male standards in the military. And I know that me and the thousands of other transgender troops, we have all worked so hard to get where we are today.
Has your status caused any issue with your fellow soldiers?
My unit that I'm in now, they're phenomenal. I'm actually not sure who knows that I'm transgender. The full-time staff knows, my lieutenant, my first sergeant, human resources. So it's kind of on a need-to-know basis. But they've been phenomenal. They have done nothing but work with me and work for me.
Do you think your transgender status has any effect on your ability to do your job as a soldier?
No. In fact, I think that it increases my ability. Just with all the adversity that I deal with personally for being transgender, I think that it makes me a very great candidate to be in the military. Being transgender has made me very mentally and emotionally tough.
What about your actual physical duties? Does it affect that at all?
No, and that's, I mean, I have to laugh at that because there's not a single thing that I can't do. I mean, in fact, I can do things better. I can do more push-ups. I have more endurance. I have had several surgeries to have my body fit what I feel the gender that I am. I've had a mastectomy, phalloplasty surgery. So aside from, you know, the normal recovery times for any surgery that anybody has, I can do my duty, if not better, than I could 4 years ago before I started transitioning. I obviously want people to see me as a male, so in the military, I want to conform to the male standards, especially the fitness standards, and that requires a shorter run time as a male and more push-ups. So, in fact, I think being transgender has made me more physically fit now more than ever.
What about the handling of weapons?
I can shoot a weapon better than I did before, and I'm not saying that's because of hormones. I think a lot of it is also emotional and mental. I feel more at peace with myself because I am who I always thought I should be. When I hear people say that transgender troops are physically and emotionally unfit, that just blows my mind. Like, I don't understand where people get these things. Where where do they get that notion that we are any less fit than the next soldier?
How could you convince them that that's not so?
Well, first of all, just on the civilian side of things, if we take out the military aspect, to start hormones, to have surgery, that requires going through therapy, talking to a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and it requires quite a bit of documentation just to even get my gender changed from female to male on my driver's license, let's say. You know, so we already go through a strenuous vetting process, if you will. So if a psychiatrist and a doctor and a therapist see me physically fit, I don't know how the military can see me unfit.
The issue of paying for hormone therapy and gender-altering surgery has come up in this debate. Is that not a legitimate issue?
I think it's an excuse. I cannot speak to what other surgeries the military pays for. I know that the military pays for breast reduction surgeries if it's deemed medically necessary. But for me personally, my hormones are $15 a month. That's it. And if you look at the small percentage of troops that are actually transgender, it's estimated that there's 6,000 active duty military members that are transgender and 15,000 overall if you include the National Guard and Reserve components. That is such a small percentage. And in addition to that, everyone's transition is different. Some people only stay on hormones and they opt to have no surgeries. Some people have all the surgeries to make themselves feel better and conform to the body that they feel like they should be in. So everyone's journey is different. Not every single soldier is going to have all these surgeries. And so if you think about the roughly 15,000 transgender troops total, not 15,000 of these troops are going to have all the surgeries or even a surgery.
You paid for most of your surgeries, if I recall correctly.
I did. I paid for my top surgery out of pocket, my mastectomy out of pocket. In addition to that, I pulled out a separate policy, which I'm paying for on my own through Blue Cross Blue Shield, that covered my other surgeries that I've had.
Why do you think this issue is coming up again?
Part of me thinks that Donald Trump hasn't done a lot of things that he's promised the people. And to me, this is him trying to say, hey, I am doing something. I'm doing something that I promised you. So I think he's just getting bored. You know, Donald Trump never served. He avoided the draft. I would personally love for him to come stand right in front of me and tell me that I am a burden to the military and that I am physically and emotionally unfit. I would love if he could say that to my face.
Do you feel better acceptance generally in society of transgender people?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, you know, people that do know me accept me. For instance, there's a soldier in my unit that for one of her high school projects, she did a project on transgender people. And she told me, she said, if I would have known that you were transgender before I got to know you, she said, I probably would have judged you. She didn't find out until later into our friendship that I was transgender. And she said, I'm glad I got to know you because now I see that you are not different. You're just Jordan. And if I would have known beforehand, I probably wouldn't have wanted to be your friend. And so there's just that big misconception.
Are there any moments of tension or embarrassment that you run into because of your transgender status?
There's that potential. And back in 2014, I had just started hormones and I had already had my mastectomy and I had to be in the same barracks as all the females. So I walk into the female bathroom, I'm embarrassed, other female soldiers see me, they're wondering why this guy is in the bathroom, so they were embarrassed. It's just, I mean, us as a transgender community go through that embarrassment because not everyone, you know, everyone can be at different stages in their transition.
How about now that you've pretty much completely transitioned? Has there also been other moments like that?
There's been moments mentally where I'm just scared that someone is going to look at me and say, that guy is trans. And I know that it's probably completely irrational, but there is that fear, and there's that fear of rejection and that fear of, I mean, even getting potentially beat up. Being transgender is a thing that a lot of people don't understand. People like Donald Trump, and I think that that's why they spout off all this ignorance. So I think that as we become a more informed community, and in a lot of ways, I, I think that we as a country are kind of more divided now than ever, but I think that we are becoming a more liberal society. And as people open up their minds to understand things that they don't know, we can get along a lot better.
This policy has not gone into effect yet. The Pentagon says it doesn't know when it will go into effect. So what message would you have for your superiors in the military right now?
Right now, more than ever, I think that we are a very divided country right now because of Donald Trump. I really have no words. I think I'm still kind of in shock, mostly because Donald Trump tweeted it. That's not very professional. So that just blows my mind in itself. There's a lot of transgender service members that are very prominent in the transgender community. They're on Facebook. I would love for all of us to get together and stand right in front of Donald Trump and our superiors and ask them what it is about us that they deem unfit.
Why do you still want to serve in the military, given that there isn't general consensus about transgender people or even gay people at this point in the military?
I ask myself that a lot, and I've been asking myself that since I joined. And that's the other interesting thing about our transgender community serving in the military. I have not heard of a single person saying, okay, I'm trans, Donald Trump wants to kick me out, I'm done. All I've heard is, I'm transgender and I'm going to fight. I would love for Donald Trump to find another group of people that will say, you don't want me in your military, but here I am and I'm going to fight to stay in. I love what I do. And the military is kind of a weird thing. Sometimes you just can't explain. You know, it's a love-hate relationship. But for as long as I can stay in, I will, because I want to serve my country. I always have. And I will continue to do so. And I will not go down without a fight.
Jordan Becker is a member of the Army Reserve. Thanks so much for talking about this.
Thank you. I'm so glad that I'm getting the opportunity to let my voice be heard, and hopefully I am a reflection of the thousands of other voices that cannot be heard.
Thanks a lot. I'm Judy Valente.
Last May, Jordan Becker received an Achievement Award from the Army Reserves for outstanding service to the military. After President Trump's tweet promising to ban transgender troops, Pentagon officials said they have no immediate plans to do so. A 2016 RAND Corporation survey estimated there are anywhere between 2,000 and 11,000 transgender active duty troops out of approximately 1.3 million members of the armed forces. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from AARP, whose nonpartisan mission is to address issues of individuals over 50 and their families. Enough is Enough is AARP's effort to educate Illinoisans about the challenges of restoring Illinois' fiscal health. More at states.aarp.org. This is 89.1 GLT.
Coming up, a conversation about the history of theater. Former ISU Provost and Western Illinois University President Al Goldfarb has a new book, and Charlie Schlenker has the interview. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Another big showdown in Springfield could be looming, this one over school funding. That's the Illinois Politics Roundtable subject this week. On the panel is moderator Sean Crawford, IPR Education Desk reporter Dusty Rhodes, Hannah Meisel, a reporter for Law 360, and Kent Redfield, an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Dusty Rhodes says the budget passed with a poison pill, requiring new school funding formula to pass before schools get any money this fall.
Okay, so the other term I've heard for that mechanism is a booby trap. I remember Representative Will Davis being very clear when that measure passed he said it on the floor that this means that you can't fund schools until we enact an evidence-based model. I think it was a little noisy on the floor, and I don't think everyone heard, but he made it very clear. So what that means, everybody agrees that we need the evidence-based model. Republicans agree, Democrats agree, the governor agrees. What they don't agree on is, you know, we keep saying that the governor likes 90% of that bill, Senate Bill 1. Senator Jason Berkman, a Republican, has an almost duplicate bill, Senate Bill 1124. The difference between them is how generous they are to Chicago public schools.
You mentioned Senate Bill 1. That's the only one that has gotten through both chambers. It's not on the governor's desk yet. That's something he's made very clear. He wants to get it there because he wants to change it. And it's all about the Chicago schools, at least from what he's been saying.
Right. And, you know, when they say the governor likes 90% of it, Senator Berkman says, yes, but that 10% is 100% of the problem. So, it's the, you know, it's how they treat Chicago public schools. It's mainly the part that the governor wants to talk about is Chicago teacher pensions. Chicago is the only district that pays their own teacher pensions. The rest of us pay for all the rest of the districts. The other part that the governor nor Senator Berkman want to talk about is the Chicago public school block grant. The numbers that the governor has put out suggest that he would eliminate most of that block grant. But, you know, even yesterday after Berkman's press conference, I caught him in the hallway and asked him about the block grant. He wouldn't say a word about it. It's like it's Voldemort.
Well, school funding is probably one of the more complicated issues that they deal with at the Capitol, maybe that and pensions. But certainly Chicago schools, I mean, the amount of students who go to Chicago schools makes up a huge chunk of what is educated in the state of Illinois. So it's a big thing to have Chicago schools get the money they need. Why is this particular thing such a big deal? I mean, like Dusty said, it sort of puts them on par with the rest of the state. Hannah, can you kind of talk about why this is such a big change?
Sure. For years, Democrats have said that other school districts in the state have gotten what they called a free lunch by getting their pension for their teachers paid for by the state, whereas Chicago public Chicago taxpayers essentially have to pay twice because they pay into the regular TIRS pension system for the rest of the state, but then they also have to pay into Chicago Public Schools teacher pensions. This is also such a big deal right now because Chicago Public Schools are facing kind of a historic budget crunch right now. Last year, they had several points that CPS CEO Forrest Claypool threatened that, you know, they might have to shut down early or, you know, in January, he said, you know, we might have to end school 3 weeks early. And they're facing a tremendous budget shortfall. They are kind of frozen on some things that they can and cannot do. For example, in 2013, they shut down 52 schools, but they're, you know, now they can't shut down any other schools at the moment to save money. And, you know, Chicago Public Schools is a huge, huge deal. They're losing a lot of students, and that's going to be an economic drag on the city of Chicago. If people don't want to send their kids to CPS, they might just forego living in Chicago altogether, which further brings down the city and its coffers.
And of course, Kent, there's a lot of history when it comes to Chicago schools, how they're funded, this pension issue. This goes back a while, including certainly back into the 90s, maybe even before that.
Yeah, I mean, historically, this has been an issue in terms of how you treat Chicago versus the rest of the state. But specifically, when you get to Chicago schools, then there was an agreement in 1995 when the Republicans had both chambers of the legislature and Governor Edgar, you know, Republican was the governor. Then there was a Chicago school reform package. It gave control of the Chicago schools to the mayor of Chicago rather than being a separate governmental entity. That was quite, you know, innovative. It was a big deal at that time. A number of cities have emulated it, some with more success than others. You know, but now it's a leverage point. It comes after the governor losing on the budget and the property tax increase. It's a chance to score political points and play regional politics. And so, you know, there's a huge policy problem that we have to work through, but it gets played out in terms of the political fight. And so nobody wants to be blamed for the schools not opening. Everybody assumes that's going to happen, but we're trying to get the maximum political advantage. The danger here, of course, is if you get down to the 23rd hour and the 59th minute, and you don't have the votes to override or accept a mandatory veto, the bill dies. I mean, so it's a very dangerous game of chicken. And, you know, the governor really doesn't want, you know, he thinks, you know, some people may in his staff may believe that if schools don't open, well, we'll blame the legislature. But it becomes a competency issue for the governor.
Kent Redfield of the University of Illinois at Springfield is one of the panelists on the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Joining him were Dusty Rhodes of IPR, Hannah Meisel of Law 360, and moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Earlier this year, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources proposed changes to the state's flood control policy that would loosen restrictions on raising levees. Environmentalists and some residents are concerned that if the amendments are approved, it will put communities along the Mississippi River at greater risk of being flooded. IPR's Ellie Chen reports.
There is a new event in the Twin Cities that focuses on the well-being.
Nancy Guyton and her husband farm in Oneida, a small town on the Missouri side of the Mississippi River. Their farm endured major floods in 1993 and 2008, but especially since 2008, she's noticed more flooding.
We've had more experiences than we should. Something is very
scientific studies say that climate change is causing more frequent floods in the Midwest. But Guyton believes there's a bigger culprit behind the rising Mississippi, high levees.
But see, it's just a bit overwhelming. It would take a lot of river to go over these.
Guyton is standing on a section of the Sny Island levee system that's located across the river and upstream from her farm. That system stretches about 60 miles long from Quincy down to Bellevue, protecting mostly farmland. It's the largest levee system in the Army Corps of Engineers Rock Island District. The federal agency released a survey this year that showed that 40% of levees in the Rock Island District have been built higher than they're supposed to be. It found portions of the Sny to be 2 or 3 feet higher than the authorized level. Since the late 1990s, the Sny Island Levee and Drainage District has been building its levees up to protect against 100-year floods, which have a 1% chance of happening in any given year. But the Illinois Department of Natural Resources is proposing new policy changes that could make it legal to add height to large levees. State regulators released draft amendments this year that would do away with requirements to obtain permits for changes made to levees that provide protection against 100-year or worse floods. Drainage districts build up levees and flood walls to protect what's behind them. Mike Reed is the superintendent for the Sny District, and he says that his district's levees are crucial to keep farmland, interstates, industry, and residents from being flooded. When the heavy rains in December 2015 happened,
we had over 15,000 acres underwater here in the Sny. And that water, without the Sny, all of that flood water would have run directly into the river.
Reed also denies that the Sny levees are higher than what the Corps authorized. Researchers say that raising levees will cause water levels to rise and make flooding worse. Nicholas Pinter is a geologist at the University of California, Davis.
You know, it's like an eight-lane highway, and you're constricting the water to a single lane. So it's inevitable that things get clogged up.
The Illinois DNR's proposed amendments are an attempt to bring the state's flood control policy in line with other states that border the Mississippi. The rules in Illinois are pretty strict. Development in the floodplain can't increase the flood stage, the level at which water will overflow the riverbanks, by more than a tenth of a foot. In Missouri, it can't be increased by more than a foot. But the reason elevations are regulated is to avoid levee wars, in which a high levee on one side of the river encourages people on the other side to build even higher levees to fend off floodwaters that get pushed in their direction. Scott Whitney is the flood risk manager for the Corps' Rock Island District.
Because it often comes at a cost or an expense to somebody else, you know, in terms of the impacts potentially moving across the river, down the river, or up the river.
So environmentalists like Olivia Dorothy at American Rivers worry that if Illinois loosens regulations on high levees, that could have dangerous results as major flood events become more common.
You know, we need to be looking at strategies that, like, drive that flood elevation down instead of pushing it higher and higher up and creating a greater risk for people that are living behind levee and people that are living in neighboring communities.
It's unclear when Illinois lawmakers will decide on the proposed policy changes. The Corps plans to release a report this September that could shed light on how levees and other structures are contributing to floods along the Mississippi. I'm Eli Chen.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. Former ISU provost and retired Western Illinois University president Al Goldfarb is not slowing down in retirement. He's just published a book about the history of theater. It's called Living Theater. Goldfarb tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker there have been new developments in recent years that merit a new edition of his classic text.
People have been writing about Shakespeare, finding a coat of arms and suggesting that that proves that all of the ideas that someone else wrote Shakespeare are not accurate.
Bogus, yeah.
Right. There's also the Curtin Theater, and the Elizabethan Curtin Theater that was built in 1577 has been excavated. Everybody thought it was circular. It is rectangular, actually. And many people thought Henry V was first produced there, where it talks about this circular, wooden O. Well, clearly that theater is not a wooden O, so it either means that the prologue to Henry V was added later, or Henry V was done at the Globe, not at the Curtin. So there are many kind of factual issues that have to be updated. The contemporary theater chapters especially have to be updated. There are many, many more significant playwrights, theater artists whom we may not have covered in the last edition that we cover. And then we also added new features in every chapter called Past and Present, where we try to show certain kinds of activities in the past continue to impact the present-day theater. For example, theater festivals today, the classical Greeks put their plays on in festivals. We talk about how festivals continue to operate today in terms of theater festivals. Shakespeare's 400th anniversary of his death. We talk about how Shakespeare was being produced all over the world last year. We talk about many theaters or buildings that continue to be used. The Colosseum has been renovated. How is that now being used today?
Contrast the festivals of the Greeks versus the festivals today. The Illinois Shakespeare Festival, for instance, or the Santa Fe Opera, which has new works every year.
Well, the festivals, the classical Greek festivals were week-long festivals. Almost everything came to a stop. Large percentages of the people attended the events. We don't have anything quite like that today because they were also built around religious festivals. So they were connected to religious festivals. But nonetheless, the idea that you have the Spoleto Festival, for example, in South Carolina, where you bring large numbers of people together, you have a large number of events, ongoing events, continuing events, actually sometimes day-long events, continues to be a similar kind of pattern. And people seem to enjoy that kind of communal interaction very much as the festivals of the classical Greek were communal interactions.
How about new movements in the expression of theater? What has happened in the last 6 years or the last decade? I mean, we've talked about, the contemporary costuming issues or rap
in Hamilton.
Hamilton and so forth.
Hamilton,
And in other places, too. Sure. They're rapping Shakespeare now.
Sure, exactly. The Q Brothers.
But what are some of the trends that are being adopted widely?
Well, first off, there are... continues to be significant theaters, connected to various multicultural groups, expansions of, theaters that reflect the diverse society of the United States and the diverse society of our world. And so we spend a good deal of time actually focusing on the various diverse theaters, both in this country and then the kind of global impact. Theater has really been globalized in many ways, almost like the way in which manufacturing has been globalized. A production might start in Paris, move to Broadway, then move to London, then tour the United States, then tour the world. Musicals are being produced throughout Asia. I mean, there is a kind of globalization of the theater in which people borrow from various global developments within the theater. So there's a sense in which the world is both bigger and smaller in terms of the theater as well. And we spend a good deal of time talking about that globalization also.
There's pushback to globalization in many entertainment sectors and cultural sectors, especially among traditionalist societies that feel threatened by that. How is that trend working out in the theater?
We actually talk about that. There are some people who view taking some of the traditions and some of the elements of traditional theaters and appropriating them in ways that might not be actually appropriate, and finding ways in which you're actually diminishing those great traditions. And we talk about that. But then there are many great theater artists who have appropriated those theatrical traditions and are use those theatrical traditions to create great pieces of theater. Peter Brook is one of the great directors of the 20th and into the early 21st century who's done that. And so we talk
in
about
what
those
way?
Issues.
Give an example.
He's created works, for example, that have used the Mahabharata, the great Indian text, to also reflect on contemporary issues. He has a new work that uses elements of the Mahabharata, and he talks about how that sort of it also reflects our contemporary world in terms of wars and aggressions in the contemporary world. And he uses many of the traditions and techniques and storylines of those materials. So, and there are many theater arts. Julie Taymor did that in Lion King, in which she used, for a popular piece, used many of the traditions of puppetry from Asian society.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Al Goldfarb, former provost of Illinois State University and president of Western Illinois University, about his new book, a revised book, Living Theater. One person's cultural appropriation is another person's mashup culture. When do you get in trouble and when do you not?
That's a very difficult question. I think the key has to be respect for the traditions that you're using, a true understanding of those traditions, and then a recognizable reason for using those traditions in ways that help audiences better understand how those traditions worked as well. And one of the debates we have in there is how do you evaluate art that was created by totalitarian societies and by artists whose points of view you might not respect in terms of their political points of view. Those are very difficult issues.
The proliferation of technology and the easy spread of information around the globe can be a benefit and a curse in developing new theater, which in your view is it?
There have been key individuals who have used technology in very significant ways. Obviously, scene design and lighting design have all been greatly impacted by technology. No matter how much technology is infused in the theater, we'd like to believe that the key element that will keep theater alive and has kept theater alive is the fact that it is an interaction between live performers and live audience. And there is something pretty special about that interaction. You can see productions that use almost no scenery, no costume, no lighting, and create a major impact on an audience just through the interaction between those performers and those audience members. One of the shows last year in New York that I saw by Simon Stevens, who's a very well-known British playwright, we mentioned in our textbook, he was the adapter for A Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's a play called Heisenberg. Uses almost no scenery. It's a two-hander, two actors. Actually, when they moved it to Broadway from off-Broadway, they put audience members sitting on stage, so the audience was, in a sense, surrounding. And that was a pretty spectacular production, as was Ivo van Hove, a very well-known contemporary director, his production of, A View from the Bridge, the Arthur Miller piece. Again, not a lot of scenery, actually actors using costumes that are kind of not time-specific, but creating a major interaction between audience and actors, and then using a couple of very striking moments of lighting or other kinds of imagery to create that production.
Is there a discernible trend, or are all these pointillistic parts of the entire theater experience? For instance, the immersive part of bringing the audience into it. There was a production of Macbeth at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh in recent years where the audience was brought into the World War I trench in which they had set Macbeth with sandbags and heat and wet and all of that.
There's a whole movement in the theater today also in terms of immersive theater. There's a production in New York that uses elements of Macbeth actually in a space in which audiences are toured through the space called Sleep No More. There are many kinds of immersive performances. The key, I think, to the contemporary theater is how diverse it is. It reflects diverse populations. It reflects diverse interests. It reflects diverse types of theater. It truly reflects the great diversity of our contemporary world. world. And so you can go from anywhere from great commercial productions in New York City to some of the more fringe kinds of productions in storefronts in Chicago or tiny theaters in London or throughout the world, actually. So, and then the subject matter is quite diverse in terms of the theatrical performance, as is the diversity of the types of experiences themselves. So,
we're talking with Al Goldfarb about his new book, Living Theater. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. Big moments in history tend to prompt significant theater movements as well. In the 1930s, there was a lot of social justice theater, a lot of theater that involved working man versus elites based on what was happening in the Depression. Are we at such a moment in this country again?
Well, you know, I always tell my students, one thing I always tell my students, by the way, when I taught theater history, was it's very hard to tell what moment you're in when you're in a historic moment. I used to joke sometimes that history at this moment is kind of gossip. It's all a kind of guess. There are playwrights who are writing plays right now about, you know, some of the worldwide issues. There's actually a very significant production called Syrian Queens, which is put on by female Syrian refugees. That's an adaptation of Euripides' The Trojan Women and deals with the issues, you know, clearly of refugees and the horrific conflict in the Middle East. It was actually done in London last year in 2016. I think there's been an announcement that Tony Kushner is writing a play about current American politics, Tony Kushner being the playwright of Angels in America. It's always hard to tell. You know, when you're sitting in the midst of that moment, it's very hard to tell. But theater has always been a reflection of its society. It has always picked up on the issues of its society, and I don't see why there'll be any difference currently. But what will survive and what will be important really becomes a question that'll historians 100 years from now will decide what was really important in 2017.
Al Goldfarb is a former Illinois State University provost and retired Western Illinois University president. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about his book, Living Theater. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You don't have to go to veterinary school to help your pet live a healthier life. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of GLT's Datebook.
There is a new event in the Twin Cities that focuses on the well-being of your pet. It's the first ever Bloomington Normal Healthy Pet Expo, coming up Saturday, August 5th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Humane Society of Central Illinois. The event has been organized by Gina LaMonica from C&G Pet Sitting, and she approached Madonna Courtright, the Director of Development at the Humane Society, to see if they would like to get on board.
I wanted to organize something for letting the community know about healthy options for their pets, whether it's a service or a product.
So we're talking about more than just getting your pet in for a checkup at the vet. This is like a day-to-day ongoing how to keep your pet healthy kind
Correct.
Of thing.
Correct, yes.
Why did you think this would be a good partnership, Madonna?
Anything that we can do once people get pets, anything we can do to help them keep their pets healthy and happy is very important.
So let's talk about the fun stuff that's going on at this event. We are going to be learning about health and keeping our pets healthy. And one of the things that you will be featuring at the event is massages?
Yes. So I teach pet massage as well as pet Reiki to any pet owners that want to learn it to help bond with their pet, or if their pet's having problems with pain or anxiety, any type of issues with separation anxiety, it's going to be great for that. So just talking about and showing them how pet massage can help their fur babies.
There's also going to be aromatherapy.
The vendor that'll be there should be able to show the pet owners what oils, what essential oils are good for pets with different issues.
Well, and also like for us as human beings to have the scents being dispersed in the air in the home would create a much more relaxing environment for them as well.
Yes, that's correct.
You're going to have some fun stuff going on. For example, a pet owner look-alike contest. Tell me about this.
Well, I thought this would be pretty fun for everybody. Basically, we're going to be judging them on how much they look like their pet. I think it should be really fun and funny.
I'm planning when I get a lot older and I'm really sagging of adopting a Shar Pei so that people think I have a twin. There's also going to be a pet costume contest. What are some good ideas, you guys, for some pet costumes?
Well, there's always the standard wiener dog, wiener bun costume.
I relish that.
Oh.
Sorry.
Sorry. So there'll be several different categories that basically audience applause is what will determine who the winner will be. So be as creative as you can when dressing your pets up for this.
So, Madonna, I understand the police canine unit will be there?
Yes, we had them there last year for our open house. They do a wonderful demonstration so that people can understand how they utilize dogs on the force.
So people need to know that this is not just the Healthy Pet Expo. It's in conjunction with the open house. It's done annually at
Correct.
The Humane Society. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be talking about adoption there as well.
We talk about adoption every day.
You sure do.
Because that's our thing. Yeah. We will be open and we will be letting people come in and
they can visit the animals.
Tour the facility and visit the animals, pet the animals. Yes. And right now we're in kitten overload. We had 41 kittens in house. So we have lots of kitties. It's not just puppies. We have lots of kitties right now. So if you're a cat person and not a dog person, we're the place to go.
Gina, you're going to have some vendors there. Who are some of your vendors?
So we're going to be having a couple different professional dog trainers there, and they will be doing some demonstrations so people can kind of see what they offer for their dogs.
Maybe Bob Ryder from Positive Transformations?
Yes, he will be there, one of my favorites. We'll also be having vendors that are selling things like dog collars, handmade dog collars. This will be a great opportunity for people to just get out with their family and their pets and have a wonderful day being out and about.
That's Gina LaMonica from C&G Pet Sitting and Madonna Courtwright from the Humane Society of Central Illinois. The first ever Bloomington Normal Healthy Pet Expo is Saturday, August 5th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Humane Society in Normal. You'll need to sign a pet waiver prior to joining in at the expo. That's available at bnhealthypetexpo.wordpress.com, or you can fill one out at the expo that morning. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In case it's a hot day, the organizers will have lots of water bowls on hand to help your pets stay cool in the summer sun. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. The ISU, WGLT, and Heil Group community are heartbroken today. Liz Larson, who worked for GLT until last week as corporate support director, died in a water accident on the Kankakee River on Sunday. She completed her first work week at the Heil Group in Normal last week. We're struggling to deal with this news personally and professionally. Former WGLT development director Carla Robustelli worked closely with Liz at WGLT. Carla, thanks for stopping by. I know it's not going to be easy, but I appreciate your time today on Sound Ideas to talk about Liz.
I wish I didn't have to be here today, Mike. Yeah. Thank you for taking the time to honor Liz.
Sure. So she had a presence and an optimism about her. How would you describe Liz?
Well, Mike, the more anyone got to know Liz, the more they understood what an extraordinary person she was and how broadly and deeply she touched the lives of people at Illinois State, here at WGLT, in Bloomington Normal, and way beyond. Liz had a vivacious personality, she was passionate for justice, and she provided selfless love for all of those around her. She was ambitious, she was funny, and she was kind. For Liz, being alive meant making her way through this crazy world with a smile on her face and a song stuck in her head. Citizenship was not a spectator sport for Liz. She experienced and engaged in our community and at our workplace with a sense of purpose and determination. She was a person who embodied, I believe, what is beautiful about this world, and it was a joy to work with her. Anyone who has ever met Liz, whether it was for the first time or perhaps you were lucky and it was more regular, you could not help but find her energy and joy contagious. You just knew that you met someone special, and you knew that the rest of your day or week was going to be a bit better because of the time you got to spend with Liz.
You said she was a joy to work with. You worked most closely with her. What was she like to work with?
Oh, it was fun. It was exhilarating, and to be honest with you, at times, it was exhausting. Liz was so passionate about the mission and vision of public radio. She was passionate about the community. She was eager to serve and to assist others. So you ask, what was she like to work with? She was amazing to work with. As a manager, she was a dream. I feel so fortunate to have had the opportunity to learn from her and to work with her. I feel so lucky to have called her a friend.
So how did she make a difference here at GLT, and what about in the community as a whole and with groups like Next Professionals?
I really appreciate you asking that. Liz made a significant difference at WGLT and in the community. By every objective measure, Liz was excellent at her job. She exceeded all goals set out for our corporate support program and worked to professionalize the program. She raised more money in our corporate support program than GLT's ever raised in its history last year. She implemented a customer service management system, which was really professionalized the way we did business. It improved how we interacted with clients. She was an excellent ambassador to the community. She served in leadership roles with the McLean County Chamber of Commerce Next Professionals. She was a member of the Bloomington Rotary Club and the Labyrinth Outreach Services at the YWCA. She was recognized for her leadership both at WGLT and her service to the community by the McLean County Chamber of Commerce
as
the Pantograph's 2016 20 Under 40 awardee.
I'd forgotten about that.
But, you know, Mike, as you know, because you worked with her, more than her professional accomplishments and success, Liz really made every day an adventure. Our old colleague Willis Kern posted on Facebook the following, and I think it really summarizes how Liz made a difference in the office. He said, "Nothing made me smile more than when I'd see Liz come bouncing into the newsroom to ask a question, offer a tip, or just chat. Her smile was ever present, and she always filled those around her with joy." And I think that's apropos.
And a favorite memory you have of Liz?
Mike, there are so many memories that I'm still sorting through. Liz's passing reminds us that moments turn to memories quickly, and it's so important for us to hold the ones we love closely while we have the time to do so. Through the love she gave to us all, I believe Liz's legacy will certainly endure. After all, if Liz was here with us today, she would remind us to keep trying to make our way in this crazy world with a smile on her face and a song stuck in her head. And that sounds like a good plan to me.
All right, Carla, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it. I know it wasn't easy, so thanks for your time. Carla Robustelli is the former WGLT Development Director and current Director of Advancement at Illinois Wesleyan University. Ryan Denham is a GLT reporter and our digital content manager. He's been following this story since yesterday. Ryan, what do we know so far about what's going on?
So at this point, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources is investigating what happened. What they know up to this point is that Liz and a 6-year-old child were in an inflatable watercraft on Saturday around 4:30 when it went over the dam in Wilmington. Department of Natural Resources are seeking any witnesses who might have seen what had happened, and those folks are encouraged to contact Will County conservation officers to kind of share what they know.
This area has a reputation. What do we know about this area, the Wilmington Dam?
It's a beautiful but dangerous spot. I mean, I've driven past it several times myself. If you're going up to Chicago and you want to hop off 55 and kind of cut over, you drive right through Wilmington and you go right past it. I spoke to a lawyer this morning, Catherine Cardenas. She represents a family who lost 2 children at the dam last Memorial Day in 2016. And she told me that Liz would be the 42nd person to drown or to die at the dam in the last several years, according to her research. She also cited a 2007 state report about some things that the state recommended to the city of Wilmington to try to mitigate the risk there. And we'll play a little audio from her.
One option was to put really large boulders at the bottom of this dam, because this dam is no longer functional. And so these really large boulders placed at the bottom of the dam would stop that underwater vortex. It would stop that swirling motion that sucks people in. the city of Wilmington has chosen not to put those boulders in. They said they, you know, couldn't afford to do that. So then the state of Illinois said, okay, we will take that dam from you. All you have to do is sign it over to us. We will take that dam and we'll make the changes necessary. The city of Wilmington has refused to give that dam to the state of Illinois.
And that was Catherine Cardenas, an attorney from Chicago who's representing a family that lost two children at the Wilmington Dam.
So what does the city of Wilmington have to say?
They won't say much right now. They're up against some litigation in this previous case back in 2016. I spoke to Frank Kaler, who's the interim city administrator in Wilmington earlier today. You might recognize his name. He actually worked in Bloomington on an interim basis as well recently. He basically declined to say, you know, how dangerous they think that dam area is right now, basically pending that litigation. He wants to see how this investigation shakes out. But the proposals to remove that dam have met resistance. The Chicago Tribune has reported on this a couple of different times. Local leaders are, you know, were trying to save what they consider to be a defining feature of their town. That main park sits on an island in the Kankakee River next to the dam, and Wilmington is actually known as the Island City, so it's sort of intertwined with the town's identity. Frank Kaler did tell me that there are signs warning people about the dangerous conditions there all over the place, at least 7 or 8 signs, but it sounds like some more work to be done.
So why is this dam, this particular dam or type of dam, so dangerous?
I think Catherine Cardenas, that Chicago attorney, kind of got into it there. It's that underwater vortex that's created. If you happen to get into the water, it doesn't look very dangerous. But if you get down there, that vortex can kind of keep you under, and there's not much you can do at that point.
Okay, GLT's Ryan Denham, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. Former GLT corporate support manager Liz Larson died on Sunday after going over the Wilmington Dam. She was 36 years old. This is WGLT Normal.